RNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. William Shakespeare has been called the central imagination of the English language. His writing and view of life and the world still very much frame our own. But Shakespeare was also a man of his time. Scholar Stephen Greenblatt has stepped into a vacuum of biographical data to flesh out that man, that genius. His new book is Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. Tonight on Point, the making of William Shakespeare and the life behind the genius. But first tonight, we turn to Washington. This morning, there was a showdown at the Supreme Court over medical marijuana. The justices will decide whether or not individual states can let seriously ill patients ease their pain by smoking marijuana, a drug the federal government has designated illegal. The Bush administration is appealing a lower court decision that allows two California women to smoke pot on their doctor's recommendation. Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate.com and was there today for oral arguments. I asked her if it appeared today that the Supreme Court was warming to the idea of medical marijuana.
I would say no. I would say based on today's oral argument, they were overwhelmingly chilly to the notion of legalizing marijuana, even for the limited medical use that California has done. It seemed that although this was a very strange case and that the traditionally conservative justices would have liked the California position for federalism reasons and the traditionally liberal justices would have disliked the California position for congressional power reasons.
That is along the states' rights line here, that the federal government ought to stay out of it. This is kind of the argument.
Exactly. I mean, this is a very strange case in that the sort of typical Rehnquist slash Scalia slash Clarence Thomas position on these sorts of things is, look, Congress has to butt out if interstate commerce is not implicated in these cases. But when you're talking about marijuana, that becomes a lot less attractive. And so then you have these conservative justices sort of sitting on their hands looking uncomfortable, and the traditionally liberal justices like David Souter and Stephen Breyer shaking their heads and saying, well, even though we sort of like people who are dying of cancer to have access to medicinal marijuana, we can't get on the bandwagon for these federalism notions that we never agreed with in the first place.
Dahlia, give us in a nutshell the case that's brought this back to the court.
Sure. In 1996, California legalized the use of marijuana for medicinal purposes under the supervision of a physician. And at around the same time, as you know, the federal government was stepping up its war on drugs and really enforcing the federal drug laws.
So the California referendum, the vote, ran into the federal enforcement effort.
Right. And essentially, this case comes down to sort of a power fight between whose laws are going to control, the state of California or the federal government. As I said, usually the federal government was completely granted deference, but the Rehnquist Court has sort of made a hallmark of this federalism revolution, the notion that states have rights and states have dignity and states should be the laboratories for experiment. And so the Rehnquist Court has sort of put a stop to the notion that the federal government gets to regulate as it wants, when it wants. The Rehnquist Court in 1995 and again in 2000 actually struck down two important congressional acts saying, no, this is not a matter that Congress can go messing with. This doesn't implicate, quote, interstate commerce the way the Constitution says everything that Congress regulates must.
So here comes the case from California, 2002 case of two women, one with a brain tumor, one with back pain, both using marijuana to deal with the pain, neither of them buying it at all, one growing it herself, one getting it from caretakers.
Well, that's the kicker, and that's why this is such an interesting constitutional question. If, in fact, Congress can only regulate cases that involve interstate commerce, what do you do when there is no interstate activity, that the folks in this case have signed affidavits saying we grow it ourselves, our caregivers grow it for us, the soil is from California, the water is from California. Moreover, there's no commerce. We're not paying for it. Money does not change hands. This is not Congress's business, they say.
So how is the court tying it to interstate commerce today, or were they?
Well, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, who heard this case on appeal, said absolutely no commerce involved. This does not come under the sort of panoply of things that Congress can oversee. But the court today had several problems with that analysis. One thing they said is, look, the drug market is the drug market, whether you're buying it on the street or planting it in your windowsill. The courts can't get into the business of making those fine distinctions. If we say it's interstate commerce, it's interstate commerce. And then some of the traditionally liberal justices had very, very clear problems with the assertion that no commerce was involved. Justice David Souter, for instance, said, look, tens of thousands of people in California are on chemotherapy. If we give them a license to use this medicinally, we're opening it up to all sorts of fraud from recreational pot users. We're not talking about a slim, slim minority of the people. We're talking about lots of people. And Stephen Breyer made an interesting point as well. He said, look, if you want to get rid of laws saying that marijuana has no medicinal use whatsoever, go to the FDA and petition to have it changed. Don't ask the courts to do it. This is not the job of the courts. So even the justices who might have been sympathetic to these claims just didn't seem to be sympathetic today.
So your sense as you heard the debate today, Dahlia, was the court seeming to lean against states claiming this right or against marijuana?
Well, I think that's sort of the interesting question. This is a court that, you know, by 5-4 decisions now have handed down two historic federalism cases saying states have rights.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you're correct. I think that the sticking point today really was we're talking about marijuana, and perhaps more profoundly, we're talking about undermining the government's war on drugs, kind of chiseling out an island that then we cannot control, and that seemed to make a lot of the justices very, very nervous.
Well, a long time until we get a ruling in this, but it doesn't look like much of a favorable attitude today.
It did not look that way from today's argument.
Dahlia Lithwick, thanks so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate.com. She spoke with me from Washington. The life of William Shakespeare got a glittering popular treatment 7 years ago in the film Shakespeare in Love, and it was all imagined. In this scene from the movie, young Will pays a visit to the love of his life as she stands on her bedroom's balcony.
My lady! Who's that? Oh, Shakespeare!
Madam! Anon, good nurse! Anon!
Master Shakespeare!
The same, alas.
Thought you the highest poet of my esteem and writer of plays that capture my heart.
And there it is from Shakespeare in Love. The movie suggests this relationship was the inspiration for Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, an entertaining idea and probably pure fancy. Still, one scholar who consulted on the film was struck by the concept of the movie. It inspired him to look at the historical, social, and political events that very likely did shape Shakespeare's work and William Shakespeare himself. Tonight on Point, we're talking about the making of William Shakespeare, tracking and imagining the life of the greatest writer in the English language. You can join the conversation. How do you picture the man behind Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet, Henry V, and all the rest? What kind of life experience could produce the mind of William Shakespeare? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Stephen Greenblatt, professor of the humanities at Harvard University. His celebrated new book is Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. Stephen Greenblatt, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
So Stephen Greenblatt, you take this mystery and you put your considerable scholarly insight and research and imagination to work on William Shakespeare, and you flesh it out to just an astounding extent. Take us from to that central question that you raise of this son of a glove maker whose parents signed their name with a mark, suggesting that they're illiterate or semi-illiterate. Begin walking us in here. Where did this guy come from? How on earth did he have a shot at becoming William Shakespeare?
He came from a very small town indeed, about 2,500 people perhaps. But his father was a significant person in the town. His father was a glove maker, but also a civic official of some consequence. He was the equivalent of mayor. It's true that both the father and mother don't seem to have left any records that indicate that they were able to read or write. I suspect the father was able to read. He preferred to leave to mark his documents with a little drawing of a Glover Shears, so he may not have been able to write. But it was a family with some local consequence. In any case, it's true that this is someone who came from a social background that generally flew below the radar of the late 16th, early 17th century. No one was interested in people who came from that background.
And there is kind of the mystery and the background that you dive into. And you're very clear right up front about the fact that while there, England in the Elizabethan era was a record-keeping society, yet the record of William Shakespeare is very, very sketchy. You write what I guess everybody knows, that biography of Shakespeare is largely speculation.
Absolutely. There's some scratchings, birth records, baptismal records, and so forth and so on, but there is very, very little of the kind that we long for. The diaries, the manuscripts with notations, the personal letters, none of this survives. Maybe very little of it existed. In any case, no one thought to save it. Such things as did exist. So we work with what we have. We know a lot about the time, and we actually know rather a lot about Shakespeare compared with other middle-class writers of the time. But basically, we have to figure out through speculation, through guesswork, through backing and filling, the answers to the questions that we long to know.
So we're going to go into so much of what you've imagined and learned in that process, but give us a sense of how you imagined your task here. What did you set out to do?
I tried to figure out who this human being was. And it's true that, as you said in the lead into this, that it wasn't the full origination of the idea, but I was quite struck when I had conversation about 10 years ago with the screenwriter for Shakespeare in Love. Didn't exist at the time. A Hollywood screenwriter came and he said he had written movies, Sword of the Ninja and Cutthroat Island.
This is Mark Norman.
Mark Norman. And he wanted to talk about doing a sort of a biopic based on Amadeus about that movie about Mozart.
Yes.
On the life of Shakespeare. And he asked me what he should work on. And I said, forget it. It's
can't
not
be
worth
done.
Doing. I mean, there's not enough out there to make a glamorous life.
And he said, not a problem.
He said, do something. I said, do something about Christopher Marlowe, Shakespeare's great contemporary, who had a fantastically interesting life, was a double agent, a spy, a violent man.
And better documented?
More police records, but not better documented.
Okay.
And he wound up with a knife through his eye. It was a great story. But no, Mark Norman said it had to be Shakespeare. So then we started to play around with it. I didn't believe that this could actually be done, but when I saw the movie, I realized that the movie had actually made hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, actually interested in what's fundamentally a literary question.
Yes.
How do you get from being a hack who wrote Two Gentlemen of Verona to being the titanic genius who wrote Romeo and Juliet? The movie's answer is Gwyneth Paltrow. It's a sweet answer. I hope it won't disappoint listeners if I say it's not historically accurate.
Right, right. And you give us a much more fleshed out answer to that question. But Jack Beatty, it is clearly a worthy subject that Stephen Greenblatt dives in on here. You just can't get much more vast than William Shakespeare. We speak English. He surrounds us.
He does indeed. John Keats said that every writer is always looking over his shoulder, and there he is. You know, what I connect with in this wonderful book, by the way, I was nearly late for this program. I was reading it so rapidly in the bookstore. But what I connect with is the old notion of the wound and the bow, that in some sense the impairments of artists make their strengths. And I get that sense here from Shakespeare's estrangement, if that's the word, from his Catholicism or his father's Catholicism, his mother's, that this was a banned faith in England, and in some way this disenfranchised him and made an energy in his play, a sense of lack, as Professor Greenblatt says, but it also made a sort of energy in his plays. I wonder what you think of that, Professor.
I think it's deeply true that he's hungry all his life for something, full of the desire to speak, full of the desire to express something, but also longing for things. The religion is an important part, and I think we should think about this, but it wasn't the only part. I think that he longed for love. I think he longed for a sense of status of gentlemanly vocation. And all of these things were out there before him, eluding him.
We're going to come back and really dive into William Shakespeare's life as imagined. We're talking tonight about the making of William Shakespeare, looking at a new imagining of the life behind the genius. My guest is Stephen Greenblatt. His new book is Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. You can join us tonight, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. The making of William Shakespeare, tracking and imagining the life of the greatest writer in the English language. My guest is Stephen Greenblatt. His new book is Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you picture the man behind Macbeth, Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet, Henry V, and all the rest? What kind of life experience could produce the mind of William Shakespeare? And how is it that a man with so little formal education saw so much? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's just be reminded here from Hamlet, the movie in 1990. Here's the ghost of Hamlet's father, played by Paul Scofield, commanding Hamlet, played by Mel Gibson, to avenge his death.
If thou didst ever thy dear father love, revenge his foul and most unnatural murder.
Murder?
Murder most foul. As in the best it is, but this most foul, strange, and unnatural. 'Tis given out that sleeping in my orchard a serpent stung me. But know, thou noble youth, the serpent that did sting thy father's life now wears his crown.
Oh, my prophetic soul, my uncle.
Mel Gibson in an earlier day, 1990s Hamlet. Stephen Greenblatt, there's so many things we want to learn tonight, but take us into these. Jack started alluding to some of the influences that you outline here, but take us into the events and the dynamics of this Elizabethan era that you see as having shaped William Shakespeare.
Well, perhaps I can take you into it by recalling lines that come just before the passage that you have just played, where Hamlet's the ghost of his father, appears before him and says that he's in a prison house, that he is in a place in which he's suffering for a certain term while his sins are being burned and purged away. Now, that language, prison house, purged away, and so forth, comes from a Catholic world that the Protestants had said was a lie. They said this in the generation before Shakespeare came of age, and Shakespeare is dealing
with Henry VIII.
This was it started with Henry VIII and then intensified under Henry VIII's son. Mm-hmm. This was a country that had gone through a religious revolution, a cultural revolution that had changed everything, and including the relationship between the living and the dead. Mm-hmm. And Shakespeare inherits that world of a damaged institution, a damaged set of rituals, and tries to figure out what he can make out of it. And I believe, as Jack said, that it's very close to the bone in Shakespeare's case. It's from his own family.
Now your imagining, or your conjecture, call it what you will, is that Shakespeare's family was secretly Catholic.
Yes, it doesn't take too much of a stretch in any case, not as much as some of the
okay.
other stretches.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare's mother comes from a family, the Arden family, which was one of the leading Catholic families in Warwickshire, in that part of England, a major Catholic family. And she's from a modest branch of it. Her father was a farmer, but the family is an important one. Shakespeare's father shows up on records that were kept by the government, wanted to know who was going to church, the official Protestant services, and who was staying away.
Mm-hmm.
Staying away was a sign that you were resisting.
Not enthusiastically embracing
Protestantism. You were holding on to your Catholic belief. And Shakespeare's father shows up on reports saying he's not attending church. Now, there's a note next to it saying he's staying home because he's worried about being arrested for death. So with all these cases, there's ambiguity. But if you take the possibility that he's not simply worrying about being arrested for death, though that too, but if you put it together with the fact that when he was a civic official in Stratford, he hired three Catholic schoolmasters for the local school. He was responsible for hiring them. And other signs of his continuing engagement in the old religion.
This is Shakespeare's father, John Shakespeare.
Shakespeare's father, John Shakespeare, the Glover.
Mm-hmm.
In the 18th century, long after Shakespeare and Shakespeare's father were dead, the people who owned Shakespeare's birthplace went to retile the roof of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And they found stuck up in between the tiles a document stitched together, an old written, handwritten document that was what they called a spiritual last will and testament, written by John Shakespeare, or subscribed to, rather, by John Shakespeare. I, John Shakespeare, declare that.
I
want prayers for my soul in purgatory. I'm a Catholic, and so forth and so on.
Oh.
Now, the document was transcribed and didn't survive, so we have no way of testing to make sure it wasn't a fraud. It's extremely unlikely, in my view, to be a fraud, connected to all of the other signs of the father's residual Catholic belief.
And you follow a trajectory forward from there. You imagine Shakespeare as a teacher for a time, and coming in, again, imagining here him coming into the company of some very well-known kind of Catholic resistors of the Protestant mainstream.
These were crazy years when Shakespeare left school. He was around 16 years old, and the atmosphere in England was poisonous. There were lots of rumors about an invasion, lots of rumors about terrorism, about terrorist cells, basically, fanatics who were willing to do anything to kill the Queen and bring England back to Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do I think Shakespeare was part of such a cell? No. But there are missing years in Shakespeare's life, and it's entirely possible.
This is from the end of his schooling to his emergence in the theater scene.
Exactly.
In London.
We know very little about him.
No university, but something went on during
Something
those
happened. And what we have a record of is from fairly early on is a report that Shakespeare was a schoolmaster somewhere in the country. He couldn't have been an official schoolmaster. He didn't have the education for it, and his name doesn't show up on the lists of official schoolmasters. That makes it all the more likely that he was working for a Catholic family probably somewhere in the north of England, where the families had considerably more independence from the state. And a person named William Shakeshaft shows up on a record who's being given a set of playing clothes and musical instruments by a Catholic nobleman named Houghton, same name as the Harvard Rare Book Library, same family ultimately. Now, that record of a William Shakeshaft being given playing clothes and musical instruments may be the clue that Shakespeare was up briefly in the north of England.
And you imagine that in that setting he may have seen these Catholic resistors drawn and quartered, killed and tortured.
Well, I'm happy to say that he wouldn't have seen them at that moment face up. Must have been a ghastly sight. But he might well have encountered the Jesuit missionaries who came at exactly this point, precisely to the house of Alexander Houghton in the north of England when Shakeshaft was there, who were in any case fanning out through the country, trying to stay one step ahead of the authorities and be missionaries for the old faith.
So let's say you've got that right, and there are other threads we're going to carry forward here, but just following this thread of Catholicism for a minute, and a kind of secret or frustrated Catholicism at that, how do you see that having played out in his work? What tension, what dynamic do you see that having brought to Shakespeare's work?
All throughout Shakespeare's work, there are signs, many, many signs, of Shakespeare's use, imaginary use, imaginative use of this old faith. So, for example, to take a tiny example, in Midsummer Night's Dream, the fairies at the end of the play go tripping through the house, and they say they're going to anoint the beds of the newlywed couples with field dew. Why field dew? Because they're fairies. From the countryside.
But
that act of anointing the beds with field dew was a Catholic practice that the Protestants had done away with, of blessing the bride beds with holy water. And there are many, many such moments all the way through Shakespeare's work. Does this mean that Shakespeare was a crypto-Catholic, a sentimental Catholic, a resisting Catholic? No. It means that he came from this background, and it means that he was fantastically alert to it and very, very good at using. He was an expert at using damaged institutional goods.
And we still got to come to this leap or this emergence as the genius that the world came to know. But Jack, we were talking earlier, you pointed out that this Elizabethan era was quite an incredible era itself, time itself for a mind like Shakespeare's to intersect with.
Yeah, some people call it a golden age, an age of when the discovery of the New World sort of infused a hope into humanity, or at least into the conscious and reading parts of it, that had not been there before, and that sort of woke the world up after the long sleep of the Middle Ages. And we've never seen the like of it. And I read once, and it perhaps is just a conjecture too, that Shakespeare was a stockholder in the Virginia Company, that he had taken a flyer in the Virginia Company. I like the idea, whether it's true or not. because there's something I sort of think of his genius, and here I apologize, as almost American. That is Whitman-esque. It's so excessive. It so touches everything. It animates everything.
Just vacuuming up the universe.
It seems to belong on this side of the Atlantic.
Stephen Greenblatt, how about that?
He did contain multitudes, as Whitman says of himself. It's absolutely true. And maybe the accent that he spoke in his own lifetime was rather closer to ours than to a British accent. Why? Oh, because linguists have done studies suggesting that the...
You mean British people sounded like Americans in the Elizabethan era?
Well, not quite, but that the accent that British people use now is a fairly late formation. And speculation is that people in West Virginia probably speak, in rural West Virginia, yeah, probably speak closer to the accent of Elizabethans.
Fascinating.
But I don't know if there's evidence. I have never encountered evidence that Shakespeare himself was a shareholder in the Virginia Company, but I do think there is substantial evidence that people who invested in the theater, in Shakespeare's theater, were also investing in the Virginia Company and in other companies of exploration. And, of course, in Shakespeare's late play, The Tempest, he shows himself to be highly alert to the issues raised by the discoveries in the New World.
Give us a sense of that theater world where these investors may have been engaged and how it would have pushed Shakespeare or pulled out of him what came out of him. There were tremendous economic pressures that he was under. It was a real commercial enterprise.
It was a commercial enterprise. It was probably a crazy thing to invest in fact, for anyone, both the New World and the playing companies, because they were wildly risky speculations.
And I was astounded to read, if I remember correctly, you write that he had to pull something like 2,000 people a day into his theater to make this pay?
1,500 to 2,000 people. There are competing venues. It goes on in the afternoon when people have to take off from work. They have to be lured across the river, leave their job behind and go to the theater. They have very, very little protection. If the city fathers had their way, they wanted to shut the things down. They thought they were horrible traffic hazards. The traffic was horrible. It was a public health nuisance. They were afraid that it was spreading the plague, as it probably did in times of infection. And if the deaths reached a certain point, they shut the theaters down. And besides, lots of people thought God didn't like plays, and they thought you should be shut down on the grounds that the theater was an evil place.
And in that environment, here's Will Shakespeare, and he's pumping out play after play after play, and they amount to just ever-increasing genius. There's the Shakespeare becoming Shakespeare part. How do you read? What made that happen? How did he pole vault into the heavens that way?
Well, the answer to that question must lie first and last in what he brought to it in astonishing gifts and an uncanny and weird and no doubt innate sensitivity to the magic of language, to an extraordinarily powerful imagination, to amazing risk-taking and a willingness to throw his mind out into other human beings, to a refusal to let anything go in his life. He seems to have had an eerie ability to pick up anything that came his way. If I'm here with you and I'm looking at you, the rest of the room is a blur for me. But Shakespeare seems to have been able to look at you, as it were, and at the same time take in everything that was going by.
Every other resonance in
so
the room.
He seems to have had 50 lives, not one, just in the time of a lifetime.
And so we heard about Catholicism as one kind of, I don't know, prompt to looking more
it's
deeply.
It's a vein that he knows how to dig into.
What other veins? What other... I don't know, sources of his ambition, of that open eye.
Well, we have a record of Shakespeare early. I think a record of Shakespeare. There's in the 17th century, someone kept a commonplace book. That was the books in which people used to write little anecdotes. And someone wrote the following verses: "The gift is small, the will is all, Alexander Aspinall." And then they said these were verses. That accompanied a pair of gloves bought at Shakespeare's father's shop, and these were verses written by William Shakespeare. So we get a little glimpse, if this is true.
The will is all. He will.
Of Shakespeare as a teenager writing jingles for his father's trade, and that is how he could have ended his life. But instead, the father loses his money. The business goes sour. Shakespeare finds himself as a teenager without a place, really, in life, and he has to figure out some way of inventing himself. It was a family with some social ambition, but they found themselves in a situation
stranded.
In which they were stranded or shipwrecked. Mm-hmm. And that idea of the shipwreck, the thing that casts you on a strange shore without your identity, and you'll have to make it up from scratch, virtually, is an idea that fascinated Shakespeare throughout his entire life. And that's a second deep strand in his invention of his world.
We've been ignoring our callers. I better turn to them. John is calling from Saugus, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
I'm from Boston.
Yes. Hello, John. You're on the air, my friend.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm from Boston.
Good.
Thank you. I was wanting to know what you thought about the controversy that maybe Shakespeare didn't write the plays. He was just an actor, and that the Earl of Oxford was the more sophisticated person who had the largest vocabulary. Apparently, the oeuvre is like 54,000 words in Shakespeare, as opposed to 10,000 words in the King James Bible. And a world traveler, obviously knew a lot about other foreign countries.
Right, right. So we've all heard about that in recent years, John. The idea
I'd like to know your take on that.
Let's get it. Thanks, John. Stephen Greenblatt.
Well, scholars on the whole haven't taken this idea very seriously, but I have to confess that I, in the writing of this book, took it more seriously than I ever had, in the sense that I felt that there really was a mystery that needed to be addressed, a question that needed to be addressed. How was it possible for a provincial fellow from this kind of background without a university education to do what he did? The trouble with the Earl of Oxford theory, there are many problems with it, but one problem is that Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford in question, died in 1604. Now, after 1604, the following plays came out of Shakespeare's and were performed: Measure for Measure, Othello, All's Well That Ends Well, Timon of Athens, King Lear, Macbeth, Antony, Cleopatra, Pericles, Coriolanus, Winter's Tale, Cymbeline, Tempest, and so forth and so on. What the people who believe this theory have to say is that Oxford left these plays behind, and then slowly, in a kind of time-release system, they were, over the next decade, they were slowly released under Shakespeare's name. Well, that's a fantastic idea, and it would take an incredible conspiracy involving lots and lots of different people, and it's very unlikely.
So you just don't see it. You think it's will.
Shakespeare was famous in his lifetime for what he did. So it would have involved getting Hemings and Condell and Ben Jonson and Francis Beaumont and Hugh Holland and lots of other people, contemporaries who knew Shakespeare, to be in on the conspiracy and lie. He was not an unknown.
Jack Beattie, here he is, not an unknown, a commercial powerhouse and literary powerhouse in his time. And yet, in all the centuries since, everyone trying to figure out, as Stephen Greenblatt's made a great effort at here, a wonderful one, how this emerged from this humble kid from the boondocks.
Yes, and you know, there's a parallelism here in trying to understand his life and his motives and what Stephen sees in the plays, this strategic opacity about human motivation. We can't understand him, just as in a way we can't really understand some of these characters in the play. Coleridge spoke of Iago's motiveless malignity. It's just there, a fact of nature. There's no going behind. And in a certain way, that's true of Shakespeare, too.
That he doesn't want to be entirely known. There are things that he's not sharing at the table. Jack Beattie, Stephen Greenblatt, please stand by. We're talking tonight about Stephen Greenblatt's new book, Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. You can join the conversation tonight. Do Stephen Greenblatt's stories of religious persecution, class boundaries, and family secrets make William Shakespeare more real, more human to you? And how about this? Is the next Shakespeare among us now the son or daughter of illiterate parents in 21st century America? Does that sound plausible? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this program comes from...
About the making of William Shakespeare, looking at a new imagining of the life behind the genius. My guest tonight is Stephen Greenblatt. He's professor of humanities at Harvard University and author of the new book, Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you picture the man behind Macbeth, Hamlet, Romeo, Juliet, Henry V, and all the rest? And does picturing Will in the World change your sense, your understanding of Shakespeare's work itself? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's get just a sample here of Henry V. This is Laurence Olivier, 1944, reacting angrily to a mock gift of tennis balls given by a French prince.
Tell the pleasant prince, this mock of his hath turned these balls to gunstones, and his soul shall stand sword-charged for the wasteful vengeance that shall fly with them. For many a thousand widows shall this his mock out of their dear husbands, mock mothers from their sons, mock castles down. Aye, some are yet ungotten and unborn that shall have cause to curse the Dauphin's scorn.
Ooh, Laurence Olivier, 1944. Stephen Greenblatt, we want to get your reading on just everything as it pours out here. Balls to gunstones and the fury over this mockery. I don't know, is there a vein that leads to the anger? That he can present the most kind of wrathful anger. What do you trace that?
What strikes me about the passage that you just played for us, Tom, is that Shakespeare was fantastically cynical about the occasions for people to go to war. He knew, and we know watching that play perfectly well, that they're not going to war over tennis balls. We've already had a scene in which people are talking about the real reasons for going to war, the secret reasons for going to war. But Henry V raises himself to this pitch of rage over this false cause. So Shakespeare understood uncannily
well. Even as he lets him rage,
he understood
there.
Uncannily well that the reasons that people claim that they're going to war are not the reasons that countries actually go to war. There's a public relations aspect of this, and then there's the real reason for this.
Now you're right, and of course we know that much of what Shakespeare wrote, he was building on extant works, things that were already there, and making them his own. Give us an
That's
example
right.
of
great,
how he did his work.
He's a great magpie, Shakespeare. He doesn't like, on the whole, to start with a blank page. He likes to take something and start playing with it, turning it around.
Something like a popular story that people knew, or an actual, performed or written work.
Absolutely, or a piece of history. Mm-hmm. What he liked to do characteristically is to take that and sometimes give you a very, very close rendition of it. He wasn't the least bit ashamed to do it, to sail very, very close to the wind and to do what we would think of as something almost embarrassing, and then suddenly to drop the bottom out. So that, for example, at the end of King Lear, everyone had read the story of King Lear. Everyone knew that story at the time. It was a famous mythic story of, mm-hmm. of English history. But at the end of the story of King Lear that everyone would have encountered, the old king's daughter, Cordelia, survives. Shakespeare mm-hmm. builds up to this, and suddenly the daughter is actually dead. Mm-hmm. That's astonishing.
The jaws drop in the Globe Theater.
Absolutely. And the original audience would have been absolutely stunned by the end that Shakespeare gave the play.
Will Shakespeare strikes again. We want to continue to trace some of these threads. Romeo and Juliet, you say, elements of his early marriage and kind of this ungainly marriage to Anne Hathaway when he was still a teenager. And
yes, he was 18. Shakespeare courted, if that's the right word, a 26-year-old woman. Maybe she courted him. In any case, from a nearby town, and we know from the unusual marriage records that survive that they had to make very elaborate efforts to get married outside the ordinary calendar for marriages. And the reason is clear when Anne Hathaway Shakespeare gives birth to their first child 6 months after the marriage. And by the time that Shakespeare was 20, they had twins, so they had three children. So Shakespeare, before his 21st birthday, had three very small children, no job, a wife that he had married perhaps precipitously, and no prospects.
But you draw a thread from that early marriage somehow into the realm of Romeo and Juliet.
Well, I think that Shakespeare, but this is entirely speculative, I think that Shakespeare is the great poet of courtship. This is not speculative. This is true. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare is our greatest poet of courtship, of just desperate impatience to marry, desperate impatience to be with one's beloved. He's strikingly not the great poet of marriage. What's strange about Shakespeare, I think, is that he is so brilliant at understanding the tremendous desire that lovers courting each other have for one another. Mm-hmm. He's not very good at representing a long-term marriage, successful or even unsuccessful. He's actually not very interested in it. If you compare him to John Milton a generation later, Milton is brilliant at representing what it's like to be married. But Shakespeare, who used everything that came his mm-hmm. way in life and who imagined everything, doesn't seem to have wanted to imagine.
Couldn't find a handle there. And in his will at the end of his life, he gives this wife almost nothing. And then as an afterthought, he leaves to her his second best bed.
Yes, the wife of 34 years First of all, he worked a real estate transaction shortly before he retired that seems to have been created precisely to keep his wife from being able to inherit a major part of his fortune. And then in his will, he doesn't leave anything to her. And then finally, he probably on being reminded by somebody, he makes that weird gesture of leaving her the second best bed. This is evidence, if we needed it, that this man who lived for most of his adult life away from his wife and children, who in effect left his wife and children back in Stratford.
They're in the country, he's in the city.
Yeah, and made no effort to move them to London. This is a man who did not have happiness in his marriage.
Roger's calling from Pasquag, Rhode Island. Hi, Roger, you're on the air.
Ah, God give you good evening, my masters.
Yes, and good evening.
What the good here? Dr. Greenblatt.
Yes.
Is there a play that has never been staged?
A Shakespeare play.
If so, why? Yes.
Well, not that has survived. There's at least one play that we know he wrote the manuscript of which didn't make it into print, though it was performed in his lifetime, a play called Cardenio. So we could say that there's one play at least that hasn't been staged since his lifetime. But everything else that scholars have found in the great first folio and then a couple of plays that were not in that all those plays have received many, many performances, some, of course, more than others.
But one that's known to have not made it to the folio.
There's at least one. So if you happen to find it in your grandma's attic, just bring it to my attention,
Roger,
please.
Do you have it there under the eaves, Roger?
No, I don't. But my pick for that would have been Titus Andronicus, although I guess those folk did love bloodletting. But
yes, and
there was a
movie, relatively successful movie of it by
not so long ago. Right.
So.
Roger, thanks for your call. I wonder about the issue of class. Shakespeare is here writing sonnets, kind of an aristocratic undertaking, but he is not, though he had some standing in his community, as you say, but he's nothing like an aristocrat. Is this him striking a pose that puts him in a position to write that? How do you read it?
It's certainly the case that in a set of works that he wrote, not just the sonnets, but these two long narrative poems, Venus and Adonis and The Rape of Lucrece, he made his bid to attracting aristocratic patronage, to attracting the attention not simply of the groundlings who were willing to pay a penny to see the play, but attracting the attention of the elite with enormous amounts of money.
That is, the groundlings who would be standing in front of the stage in the Globe Theatre as opposed to those better off up in the balconies.
Yeah, and I should say that actually all of Shakespeare's career, he had to figure out his theatrical career, he had to figure out how to have it both ways. He had to figure out how to get those who had the sixpenny seats that were expensive at the time,
right,
and those who just paid the penny to get in to stand around the stage. So one of the reasons that his works are so remarkable, one of the reasons that they still appeal to us, is that he finds a way of reaching an enormous audience, not simply an elite audience and not simply a popular audience. But in the case of the sonnets, I think that he was hired originally by people in a particular circle, an aristocratic circle, to write sonnets that try to persuade a petulant and spoiled young man to marry. And I think that accounts for the first 17 sonnets.
You mean literally he was set up to be a kind of
I think
of,
he was hired basically to
prompt.
Do it. He's a very, people understood he was a fantastically good writer. And they get Shakespeare to start this enterprise to try to persuade the young man to take a wife, because there was a lot of money at stake in this. But I think Shakespeare got in way over his head in this relationship. That is to say that what happens is that the patronage relationship, the relationship of servant to aristocratic patron, goes very, very strongly awry for Shakespeare and possibly for the young man himself. They become too attached to each other.
And this is the young man who's sometimes considered his lover, or...?
Yes, there certainly these are poems that are among the most passionate love poems in the English language, and most of them are written to a young man, not to a young woman.
Lawrence is calling from Methuen, Massachusetts. Hi, Lawrence, you're on the air.
Good evening. And I'm always bemused when people say that Shakespeare couldn't have written a play ascribed to him because it wasn't this university graduate who is conversant with all the verbiage and the literary heritage that he might have had by being a brother with Ben Jonson and the others. I'd like to say that music has three Shakespeares, Johann Sebastian Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven. They were skilled artisans in their art form, but they weren't university graduates either. George Merrick, in his biography of Beethoven, said that when he wanted to multiply 8 by 7, he'd add a column of 7/8. That's how far his regular education had gone. And my favorite painter, Johannes Vermeer, he, of course, was a native of this provincial town, Delft, and painted what he saw, and he became to the light what Shakespeare was to words. So,
but let me ask you, Lawrence, doesn't it, I mean, absolutely, he clearly did it without that, and it wasn't an impediment, but still he dwelt in the land of words, which one might think a university education would be more directly related to than painting or music.
Well, he was a voracious reader. Beethoven in later life became a voracious reader and hoped at some point to write an opera, I think, based on King Lear, if not some other Shakespeare play, but based on translations from is it Hesse or Heine?
I agree with you, Lawrence, that university education in Shakespeare's case would have given him a very elaborate theological vocabulary. And I think it's significant that Shakespeare didn't write the play Dr. Faustus. It's Christopher Marlowe who writes that play because it's about a scholar and it's about theological issues. But I don't think that it would have substantially increased either Shakespeare's vocabulary or his imaginative resources.
Lawrence, thanks for your call. Stephen Greenblatt, you mentioned Shakespeare's children earlier, and they do come into play in your interpretation quite dramatically. I don't know if we have time to read. Our clock is running down, but give us a sense of how his, particularly his son, Hamnet?
Hamnet is his...
And his death figured in.
Shakespeare had twins, as I say, in his 20th year. The twins were named Hamnet and Judith after neighbors in Stratford. And the little boy, Hamnet, died in his 11th year. And there's a debate, of course, there's a debate about everything with Shakespeare, but as to whether it registered on Shakespeare at all. So those people who say it didn't register much point out that...
That is, they were inured to it.
Yeah, that first of all, about one out of three children was likely to survive at this time. And that that Shakespeare went on to write some of his happiest comedies in the years immediately after his son's death. I don't believe this is true. That is to say, I don't believe that the grief that a father feels at the loss of a child has to come out instantly in the things that he writes, that it's entirely possible that several years later, not very many years later, but 3 or 4 years later, when Shakespeare sat down to write Hamlet, the name itself is not
Hamlet.
Only accidentally related. These are virtually the same names.
And that extraordinary grief that we find in Hamlet.
Exactly. That is a outpouring of grief having to do with the experience of the death of the son and then the experience of the impending death of his father. His father was dying in the year that Shakespeare wrote that play.
Jack Beattie, it's an awful lot of fun to hear someone as knowledgeable as Stephen Greenblatt just go and go and go on Shakespeare, and we begin to have a sense of who could have brought that tremendous body of work.
Yes, and that tremendous empathy extending even to the reviled figure of the Jew, which Christopher Marlowe and the Jew of Malta had none of. And, of course, Shylock, just before his end, gives the speech of empathy. I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes, hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cool by the same winter and summer as a Christian. If you prick us, do we not bleed?
Plug in almost any outside the mainstream identity there, and it's a very, very contemporary passage. Stephen Greenblatt, you must have felt how people respond even today to Shakespeare.
Yes, he turns out to be, for many, many, many people, the central, the deepest literary experience of their lives, the person who can give them the most pleasure. He certainly gives me the most pleasure.
It's a terrific book, Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. Stephen Greenblatt, we're so grateful to you for being with us tonight.
Thank you very, very much, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, wonderful to have you along. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophus.